We are here again, back with the Narnia Web Council, and we are here with an old friend who has not been here for a while, but we finally got her back on. Gents, joining us from Scotland. Gents, how are you doing?
I'm fine, thank you, but just watch who you're calling old.
Well, hey, old as in, I'm a young person, so to be young
is digging.
Just,
keep digging.
Old is just a little ways away. I'm 20 years old, so to me, old is, my goodness, 8 months ago? Wow. How long ago was that? You know? Wow, that's a long time. I haven't seen you for months, weeks.
Yeah.
That's my perspective. Okay, so no, I'm not calling you old.
Good.
Yeah. But we're going to go ahead and pick up after the night raid, which at this time I have still to edit and put up on Narnia Web. So it's a little bit odd from Jin's perspective because she hasn't gotten to hear it yet. But basically we're picking up right where at the scene Short Tempers with Caspian and Peter. And real quick, actually, before we jump in, Jin's, I'd like to kind of hear about, briefly, your experience just with the, you know, because you went to the premiere, and also overall what you thought of the film, just kind of in brief.
Okay. Yeah, I went to the premiere down in London, and that was a great experience. It was a great atmosphere to see this film in for the first time. It was a shame that we kind of got made to believe that exciting things would be happening inside the arena, so we went straight in and then discovered that all the fun was outside and we couldn't get back out again. So we were disappointed we didn't get to represent Narnia Web directly to the cast and crew of the film as they walked down the red carpet, but that's life. The film overall, I really liked it. I maybe had quite low expectations going into it, to be honest. And I have disassociated the books from the films now. I really only think about the books when there's something obvious from them happening in the films. I don't expect the films to be exactly like the books are anymore. So I think that also helped me enjoy the film as a standalone film in its own media.
Yeah. I'm trying to remember what expectations I had. I guess I was just towards the end, I just got very, very excited, and I just wanted it to be over and finally see it, because I remember going through different parts where, oh my goodness, this is going to be so good, and then at some points, oh, I'm just going to not enjoy it at all. But so I'm trying to remember, how many people would you say were there at the premiere?
10,000.
10,000.
Mm-hmm.
That's a big screening.
Yeah.
I was at a fairly big theater, but nothing at all like that. I mean, I guess that was, what's that? Is it a stadium setting? That's what it looked like to me.
Yeah, it's a stadium. It's been used for, last year they had NHL ice hockey and NFL American football. Some teams came over and played like one-off games down there. So it's big enough for that. Yeah. And it's big enough for big arena pop concerts and rock concerts and things like that too.
Okay.
That's what it's mainly used for, is concerts.
Huh. Interesting. I can't imagine watching a movie with 10,000 other people.
I think the stars got... Sorry, I think when Andrew Adamson and the cast came out front of the screen before they showed the film, they were obviously in awe of just what the noise was like and what the atmosphere was like. There was loads of people whistling and cheering and yelling and clapping, and they just, and it was dark, so they couldn't see the crowd, but just to hear that noise must have been quite exciting for them.
The film, from what I understand, has been doing pretty well in the UK.
Sorry?
Has the film been doing pretty well in the UK?
It's been doing okay. It hasn't really been pushed as much as I would have liked to have seen it, you know, advertised, and not many posters up about it either, so I'm a bit disappointed in that. It's done okay. It's opening weekend. It was the number one film in the country, but then it didn't have that much competition.
Okay. Well, that's good. Well, let's see. Yeah, we'll go ahead and jump right in. And, of course, in the scene, Short Tempers, it's right after the night raid. And Lucy asks Peter what happened, and he says, well, ask him. And Caspian and Peter go back and forth between saying, well, if you hadn't, you know, left the plan and changed everything and you hadn't messed up, well, if you hadn't done it in the first place, and basically this big argument, and they draw swords at the end, and Edmund, the voice of reason in this scene, stops them. So I guess this really is a point to discuss, you know, what we think of just the character development between Peter and Caspian and the interaction between them. And what do you think? How do you think this played out? Do you think it, I mean, obviously it's different from the book, but is it a good kind of different? Do you think it helped the film, even if maybe you dislike it? What do you think?
I think it felt right. Just the tension between them had been building and building, and then they had the disastrous raid scene. So I think they had to have a scene where they just ended up, you know, just let their emotions out and went at each other. But thankfully, Edmund stopped them before anything ridiculous happened. So, yeah. And we're going to go on and do the next scene as well, aren't we? And that just, that argument with Peter just gets Caspian in such a vulnerable place that you can then open into the sorcery and sudden vengeance scene without thinking, well, why is Caspian suddenly turning? But that's why, because he's vulnerable and he gets taken advantage of.
That's interesting. I think, you know, I watched the film, then I read the book, finished the book, and then I watched it again. And all in the same weekend, basically. And so I kind of got a lot of that. Weekend was entirely Prince Caspian for me. I don't know how I survived finals, being the beginning of my finals week. But it was so interesting because I always saw, I knew they were going to restructure the story, and I knew one of the big things they were going to do was basically pull the Pevensies in earlier into Caspian's timeline.
Yeah.
And I thought, well, in that, if you think about that, there's a lot of things in the book. We know there was a big battle in the book that they all put their hopes on that failed. And there were heavy losses, which happened in the film, although a different place and time, you understand. And you does say there were short tempers. So in that light, I don't think it's quite as big a departure. And ironically, of all the little changes they made to Peter's character throughout the film, I think this scene isn't so bad compared to, say, you know, I think the one scene really that I disliked most was, you know, earlier on where, you know, he has that little bit with Trumpkin where he says, well, that explains it, then you're mistaken. That's the one. I think if you cut out any one bit of Peter being arrogant, any one scene, that scene back there would have been the biggest impact of, you know, well, there it wouldn't.
Yeah.
If you take that out, it wouldn't have. He wouldn't have come across nearly as big a jerk here. I really think it's a very much. It's a very logical confrontation, and I don't think it was. I do think, to an extent, they have lost the reverence that Caspian has for Peter,
and also the honor and the grace that Peter shows to Caspian.
And I think that was sacrificed for. Unfortunately, a feeling of, well, we need to make it more realistic for a modern audience.
Yeah.
And I think it sort of makes sense, but they did definitely lose some very good bits from the book, even if the film has its own merits in this respect.
Yeah.
So I don't think it is a lot of damage, but I do think some things are certainly lost in this scene between the two characters. And not so much with Caspian, but more with Peter. Because, you know, with Caspian, they've got, you know, the voice of the Don Treader. And I don't know what directions they're going to take the character in that one. I would expect it would be because they don't have any... You know, even in that one, they have a little bit of rivalry between him and Edmund when they're both under the influence of the Death Island. Deathwater Island. But I think that here, that's the reason that I am probably the most... defensive about Peter is because this is Peter's exit from the Chronicles, at least for a long time. And we don't, if they stay completely true to the books, then we won't see him till the last battle. And I guess that was why I felt kind of sentimental about this, because you don't get as much, you know, with Peter as you do with Caspian, because Caspian's in, especially Lucy and Edmund, they're in I think more than any other. I mean, they're in the Prince Caspian, they're in the Land of the Witch and the Wardrobe, the Voyage of the Dawn Treader, the Horse and His Boy, and they're in the Last Battle. So they're in there quite a lot, and Peter really gets these two bits of attention. And I guess if I just felt, because he's my favorite character, if you take away a bit there from him, it's quite a big chunk, but that's me. Well, let's see. And I guess one person did point out to me that they do say dear little friend twice, although it's not the Pevensies referring to Trumpkin, it's just Trumpkin referring back to Lucy as dear little friend.
Yeah.
Kind of returning it. But, oh yes, then we go, it's not really a scene, it's more just a little montage of the Telmarines with Miraz and Miraz being crowned. And I think, actually, and I was talking to one Narnia Weber about this, Caleb 70, who I went to see the film with, and he has some issues with the film as far as, you know, how the Telmarines are responding to Miraz. Like, you know, why are they cheering when the Narnians come in? I think, actually, if they made it a little more obvious in the scene with the crowd outside cheering that they weren't really a happy crowd, I think if they hadn't, maybe if they just cut out that little bit there and made it very apparent to the audience that the people of the land really did not like Miraz, I think it would have helped the film. So that's...
I saw it from a different viewpoint there. I think what Miraz does is spin the events very effectively to make the Telmarine nation afraid of the Narnians, and therefore they're glad that they've got this strong king coming in who's going to get rid of this renegade population that they feel threatened by. So it didn't sound false to me that they were happily cheering Miraz as their king. I think they see him as some kind of protector against what they believe is the evil Narnian race.
But even if it makes sense there, is that really a good direction, do you think, for the filmmakers to take if people are supposed to be liberated by the Narnians by the end of the story? Because I think that's the idea, is that because of Aslan coming back,
That's why the last scene didn't make sense to me. When they're riding through the Telmarine villages and everybody's cheering them, that changed to me, because I had been spending the whole time thinking this Telmarine population has been manipulated by Miraz to fear these people that they're now cheering. So how did that happen? I'm obviously the opposite from what Caleb was talking about. He thinks the happy with Miraz people is odd, so that the happy with the Narnians makes sense, whereas I'm the other way around.
Well, he thought that if the people were cheering for Miraz at the beginning, then it wouldn't make sense that they would be cheering for the Narnians, because they just fought a battle.
Oh, that's exactly it, yeah.
It's sons and fathers who have died in battle. And
I totally didn't get how that was brought about so quickly. Because I thought it made sense to me that, they would be cheering Miraz as their king.
Well, I guess in the film it makes sense that they'd be cheering for Miraz, but I guess, I think that, you know, just reading the book, when as Caspian gets older, of course, you can explain things in a little line that would take longer to do on film. Like, it just says that Caspian learned that Miraz was a cruel and hard man, and that the taxes were high and the people were very unhappy.
Yeah.
And, you know, of course, Miraz in the book had been king a while by that point. And I thought it was interesting. I guess one thing with the movie, I never really completely understood why Miraz waited till now to become king. I guess it just didn't make that much sense to me. If he's obviously gotten rid of all these different lords, you see all the empty seats.
Yeah, I spent so long trying to count if there were 7 empty chairs in that hall. It's so frustrating.
Oh, you did count?
Well, I try to, but they would change shot every time I thought I'd got a firm number on it. But I wouldn't be surprised if they had deliberately left 7 empty chairs.
Although in the book it was more than 7, because some were shot by chance in hunting accidents. But do you think why do you think in this story, in the film, Miraz is crowned so much later?
I think because because they have this council of lords, so those people know that Caspian is rightfully the king. Mm-hmm. I don't think there's any kind of what's the word in the book. Does Miraz not hide it from Caspian that he's the rightful king? Or somehow Caspian's confused because he's so young, he doesn't realize this. But I think
Cornelius just says, I'm surprised you never asked me why you're not king yourself.
Yeah, yeah. But for someone in the film Caspian to get to that age and not realize that your father was king and you're rightfully the heir would just be strange. So mm-hmm. I think everybody knows that Caspian's rightfully king, and Miraz is kind of happy just under the radar until his son is born, and then that's when his schemes come into play. That's when he realizes he's going to go for the throne, and he has to convince mm-hmm. the remaining nobles that he's right to go for the throne. And once Caspian apparently turns against the Telmarine people,
if he convinces everyone that Caspian is leading this rebellion, with the like the raid on the armory and everything, mm-hmm. then he could just say, well, he's clearly gone against Narnia, so I'm going to assume the kingship. I guess that makes sense. I'm still not exactly sure how old they're trying to play the character. I guess around 17.
Yeah.
Trying to play him, but...
Yeah,
I keep forgetting it. Of course, it's just different perspectives here where we live. You live in a land where you've had young kings in your history.
Uh-huh.
And we never had that here, so I guess
we've had young kings and we've had corrupt regents and people that say they're going to take care of the land while the king or queen grows old, and then do exactly as Miraz did. So
I guess Cornelius in the book would have to say, I guess Lewis would have to write Cornelius as saying that he was surprised that Caspian never asked why he was why he wasn't king.
Yeah, and also in the book, is it not that all the lords that are left are all like loyal to Miraz anyway in the film? There,
that's the idea.
Not...
Well, how loyal? Because they kill him. But yes, that's
the idea. Know what I mean. They're quite happy to let him take power, but in the film, there's schemes within schemes. So, mm-hmm. I think that's another reason why he had to wait so long before going for the crown.
Probably. Okay, that scene. Well, we exhausted a scene with no dialogue. Congratulations.
It's one of my favourite bits in the movie, that actually. Blood ran cold when that came on. It was just...
I thought it was good. And the Telmarine theme coming on at that point, it was...
And there was also the geeking out about the different regions. I heard the crier say, Ettinsmoor pledges its troops. You know, you could pick out Verona pledges its troops, all these different areas of Narnia that you know from the map and stuff. But, I think it's another nod to the fans kind of thing.
It's also the last time you see the throne room, which was my favorite set probably in the whole film. I don't know why. I just love it so much. But I guess it's because that set is so distinctly not Narnian.
Mm-hmm.
It's something, it just jumps out at you as something that shouldn't be in Narnia. It's like there's something wrong with this room. It represents something that does not belong here at all.
Mm-hmm.
So let's see. Okay, Sorcery and Sudden Vengeance. This is the scene that Glumpuddle says you could probably completely cut out of the movie and you wouldn't miss anything.
Uh-huh. Fair enough. He's entitled to his opinion.
Well, I disagreed with him, and I'll give my reasons. But
I think if they cut that out of the film, they'd have to come up with another scene that gets Peter and Caspian on friendly terms with each other, because that's what this scene
exactly.
Is.
Okay, we're already into it, because in the book, it did serve a slightly different purpose. It was all about whether or not Caspian and Truffle Hunter and Cornelius really still believed that the old kings and queens would come, and how faithful they were. But here, it's more about whether or not Caspian's willing to go a different route.
Yeah,
I think it does serve a good purpose in the film, but it also is the closest thing you get to any kind of resolution between Caspian and Peter. Mm-hmm. They had that little tiff earlier, and they didn't really ever, there's no real resolution there, except you get that in this scene with, of course, Peter Ruskin running to Caspian's aid. You get the idea, all right, they are on the same ground here. But that's the closest thing you get. And without this scene, I don't think you would get that at all.
Yeah, no, not at all. And I know when we heard rumors and saw pictures of this scene before we saw the film, everybody was like, no, the witch cannot appear. This cannot be happening. But when I actually saw it, I was just like, ooh. You know, in fact, 10,000 people at the same time were drawing their breath in very quickly when she came on the screen. And it was just, you could feel the chill in the O2 Arena. It was just
most people
amazingly.
Loved it.
Yeah,
I think a lot of people I talked to really like. They wish that the witch had actually come back.
Yeah,
of course, I didn't really like it. I never had a problem from the idea of this scene. It was always a question of, I thought, because in the book never really, in my opinion, answers the question whether or not they could have really brought the witch back.
Mm-hmm.
But in the film, the idea is, well, they could have, but they didn't actually go through with it. And plus, might I say right here, I have always liked werewolf stories and movies and things. I've seen a whole bunch. You know, I liked the Underworld movies as bad as they were. And I actually think this is probably the best conception of a werewolf I've ever seen. I just really liked it. It just looks so... Howard Berger and his team did such a good job. It looked real.
Yeah.
It didn't look fake at all.
Am I right in thinking that that's the second bad wolf that has the American accent?
Because
in Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, it was the evil wolf was American, and in this one, the evil werewolf is American. So I think they're running on a theme here.
I disagree. no, I did not. I didn't notice that, actually.
Did you not? Oh, it's like quite...
It's so gruff. Show me your enemies. At that point, everyone sounds the same. You could probably argue, but you could probably go on a theme there. Wolves,
yeah,
American.
I think they've made all the bad wolves American. Anyway, sorry.
Well, I don't really care. The accents in Prince Caspian are all over the place anyway. It's actually, I didn't notice it the first time I watched it, but the second time I watched it, I hear Spanish, I hear Italian, I hear Mexican, and I'm, okay.
I didn't notice that as much as Lucy's switching between south of England and north of England, which she does a fair
bit. She does. Where's Georgie from?
Georgie's from Yorkshire. So fair enough, it's hard for her. I would think it would be hard for anybody to maintain a consistent south of England accent, which is quite different.
And so, Georgie's trying to do a slightly different accent than...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
She's trying to sound like Anna and William and Skander, who all have that accent naturally. Georgie doesn't.
Yeah.
And she does a great job, but there's just some scenes where her vowel sounds...
Well, I was watching... I actually work in a center at the university for Russian and Eastern European studies, and so I hear Russian accents all the time. And it was interesting for me watching Indiana Jones and the Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, because you have Kate Blanchett, who's doing a Russian accent.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time it was pretty good, but every once in a while she would say, Dr. Jones. And I thought, that's the British part coming in. The Russians would say, Dr. Jones. That's how they would say it, but she says, Dr. Jones.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway. Yeah, I think... Aside from the American wolf, now there was one thing that was a big issue for people, even for me, was okay, how is Caspian going to be going along with it? And I think it's pretty clear once he understands what's going on. No, he doesn't want to go along with it. There's some kind of trance that he's under.
Yeah.
And I didn't really like that Peter is under the same trance when he pushes him out of the way. I thought, oh, great. Now it's Peter under the trance.
Yeah.
But
I don't know if that was... I mean, to me, that scene just shows Edmund in a wonderful light.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he saves his brother again, and I just don't know...
Great moment for me.
I don't know whether it's just showing that Peter is so human scene, or Yeah, I would have liked Peter to be resistant, but then if he was, then, like I say, Edmund wouldn't have got his glory moment of saving the day in the end. And there was that symbolism of Edmund stabbing the witch.
Yeah, I did find... You know, it's interesting, because, of course, the big fear with a lot of Narnia warriors was, okay, is Peter going to come across as a jerk? A lot of the reviews I read from people who... had not, maybe not read the book but had seen the movie, really did still like the character of Peter. And one person pointed out that they kind of wished that they really liked the Peter in Prince Caspian more than The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe, because they thought that Mosley did a much more interesting take on the dynamics of the character and leading this kind of resistance in this position. And I think I really can't really... It's easy to sort of take our frustrations out on the actors at times. And on one level, yes, of course, it's, you know, the actors portraying the characters. On another level, they don't write the scripts.
No, that's what I was going to say. I have been quite conscious of the fact that it's not the actors that... like, if there's a bit where I really cringe or I really don't like it, it's not
like Susan fighting
the actors. It's because of what they've been given to say or do. In some cases, they do and say what they've been told to honestly and with a lot of skill, but I just disagree with some of it.
Yeah, but I'm not going to bash even though I am most displeased with Susan's portrayal in Prince Caspian more than any other character. I can't really blame Anna Popplewell. I think
not at all.
I think she did a good job. I really do.
But just to go back to the first time that we see the Pevensies and Peter's having to explain why he got into that fight, and he says, he bumped me. I have never heard anybody in this country use that turn of phrase, he bumped me. He banged into me, he bumped into me, that would be fine, but just he bumped me.
I was like,
where did that come from? And that was a shame, because, you know, it's one of the earliest scenes in the film and already my back's up, because I'm like, who wrote that? Who made him say that? It just what didn't sound authentic coming out of the
1950s
at all.
You maybe blame the New Zealander Andrew Adamson instead of an American on this one, okay?
I'm not laying blame anywhere.
No, I'm kidding.
He bumped. No. It's just not believable. Sorry.
Well, actually, okay. I actually did not. If my history is correct, watching Pirates of the Caribbean 1, when the girl says it's okay on the ship, I don't think that phrase came around until the 1920s.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure from my learning that it was first being used around really in the 1920s. So that jumped out at me, but. Where did that come from? I don't know.
Yeah.
So I don't think that the scene just kind of jumped out from nowhere. This film, I think that actually there was some leading up to it. I do kind of understand just from a White Witch perspective. Okay, well, the White Witch just kind of coming out of nowhere, but I mean, actually, I always thought it was kind of weird in the book that. Here's this talk of bringing the White Witch back, but I do wish that Truffle Hunter had been in the scene. I think the one thing, if I were to have a big complaint with the scene, more than anything, is probably that the great dialogue that the book had is missing in the scene. So, but oh well. Let's see what else. Caspian and Cornelius.
Oh, right. Okay, yeah, that bit.
This is short. It's a good little scene, though. I really like that at least Dr. Cornelius had one more bit to say. Because after the dungeon, he doesn't really come into the story much at all. You're kind of... I think I even put this out in the Night Raid. When we were discussing this. At one point, you think... You know, Dr. Cornelius is probably doing okay in the dungeon. You know?
Yeah.
He's probably going to survive. They could have just But I did notice that maybe, I don't know. I am, did it seem to you that when Caspian gives the line, "Then I failed you," that it comes across as not a Spanish accent? It sounded like he kind of slipped into his native accent.
He's like, "I failed you."
It sounds like, the second time I noticed, it sounded like he said, "Then I failed you." And he has that glide that he wouldn't, I don't think he would have had if he was doing his Spanish accent.
Well, I can't say that I noticed it.
Well, then someone can email me after they watch it again and tell me if they notice it.
Yeah.
Maybe I'm completely wrong.
I'll look out for it. If I see it again, I'll look out for it.
It seemed to me that when I watched it again that two guards in the boat who were going to dump Trumpkin off sounded like they had British accents and not the Telmarine accent, but the others disagreed with me.
British accents?
That's what it sounded like. It sounded like the two guys from Pirates of the Caribbean, actually.
No, I wondered if they were, I don't know. Like, if they sounded anything other than like the Spanish, then they were maybe a little bit Eastern European. I was wondering if I didn't know if they were from New Zealand or where they were from originally. Yeah. That might have been their original accent coming through. But I wouldn't.
Yeah, maybe they were New Zealand.
Yeah,
that could have been. The film was filmed all over the place.
Yeah.
Let's see. What else do we have? Telmarine Omri arrives. Do we want to go ahead and? Let's go ahead and wrap up with this scene. Telmarine Omri arrives. Did I give that to you? On the. Yes, I think that was the last scene I gave you on the. That I sent to you there.
The Telmarine army arrives, and then the planning in the stone table room.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But, it actually starts off with Peter and Lucy.
Uh-huh.
And I have to say, I thought this was a nice little exchange.
Yeah, it's good. Showing Lucy really is the heart and conscience of the,
mm-hmm.
the story.
And to see Peter...
But without...
Yeah.
Without seeming patronizing or...
Yeah,
you know,
but to see Peter making himself
Georgie did
vulnerable.
Really well, I think, because she could have come across as just preaching.
Yeah, but, and I think it's a film is, I have to say, this is one of the more quickly paced films I've seen in a while, and in a film that moves so fast and where there's so much action, I think it's somewhat easy at times to forget that they're siblings, which you definitely did a really good job of establishing that in the first one.
Yeah.
And, here, I think, is one of those scenes that also reminded me, okay, here's a big brother, little sister, and throughout the book, I think, the books and even in Land of the Wardrobe, Peter always had a special fondness for Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that is shown here, and I really liked just that this scene had a presence in the movie, no matter what they were discussing.
Yeah. Yeah, I think there's a lot sort of not said in that scene.
Mm-hmm.
It still comes across. Because it's hard for a big brother, especially from that day, needs to admit to his little sister that he's not in control. And, you know, he's made lots of mistakes. And just you're lucky, you know, to have seen him. That is just Peter admitting, you know.
And it's only four lines, but it still sticks out to me as one of the more memorable scenes.
Yeah, he's just sort of kind of saying that he wished he'd listened to Lucy sooner or something.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can take a lot from that. And then, you'd better come quickly. That is the most used line in that film, it must be.
Really? How often do they
Susan,
say it?
You'd better come quickly. Pete, you'd better come quickly. You'll want to come and see this. That is, you use an awful lot to join from one scene to the next.
But, do you think, let's see, yeah, there we go, better come quickly. And of course, you know, then we have this little, you know, the second exchange around the stone table.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, this kind of sets up this is really the beginning of the third act more than anything.
Uh-huh.
And I think that it's, I mean, this is just kind of a place to talk just about the idea of going to, you know, set up the plan for Lucy to go off and find Aslan and for them to hold off and wait there.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the idea thematically is still there, but I just don't think that this really works as well as
I thought it was quite weak.
Yeah,
as a plot point. I'm wondering if they filmed more to explain where this idea why it would work, sending Lucy into it. I wonder if they filmed that and had to cut it out, and hopefully it's in the extended edition or something like that, so it'll just move a wee bit more smoothly. Because it seemed quite sudden to me that someone had come up to this with this idea of, if we send Lucy and Sue off into the woods, they'll meet Aslan. I mean, I don't know.
Seemed
a little bit weak. I know they had to somehow get Lucy to meet Aslan, and this was maybe the best thing they could come up with.
And just so everyone knows, we have not heard any official word on an extended version. But I
would hope.
It just doesn't. I think here's the thing. They didn't really, in the book, it splits off. You have the boys, Caspian, Peter, and Edmund, and you have the girls with Aslan and Susan and Lucy.
Mm-hmm.
The Aslan, Susie, Lucy bit is the part they really changed. The bit with Peter and Edmund, and I mean that with Miraz, that was kept pretty close to the book, except for the little bit with Caspian maybe killing Miraz. You know, the same character kills Miraz. It's pretty close to the book,
mm-hmm.
but because I think this is going to be the weaker part of the story
involving
the girls, if that's the part they completely change and deviate from the book on.
Yeah.
But I would like to say this. I think this is actually one of Trumpkin's best moments in the film, where he just, the one line he has where he says, "Haven't enough of us died already?"
Yeah.
It's like a different take on the character all of a sudden.
Yeah.
Normally he's I'm all rough and tough and I'm a nasty little dwarf, blah, blah, blah. And here it's this really good little moment with him.
Just the way he looks at Lucy when he says that, it just, breaks your heart. It's very good.
Yeah. And I think, again, this is a much more, for all the film's flaws, I do think this film did capture that these are real people. The Narnians are real people much better than the first one did. I don't think the first one... I think the Beavers and Tumnus, that they were real characters, but everyone else, it was hard to really care if they survived. You wanted the heroes to survive.
Yeah.
But and you wanted Aslan to come back from the dead. But here you really care for everyone, which I think is definitely an improvement. And of course, the Bulgy Bear. I love that.
Yeah, poor Aslan. Poor David Walliams. Two words in the whole film.
Some people came to me and they say, "What did he say?" I said, "He said for Aslan." Oh, okay. I couldn't make out what he said.
Yeah. I'm glad he got a little bit in there.
They had to have... he's just one of those characters you have to have.
Mm-hmm.
But, I think... And again, another reason why this is such a good thing with Trumpkin is just Trumpkin's insistence that, they didn't have the dialogue where he's with Caspian and he says, "Well, send me, sire, I'll go." And he says, "I thought you didn't believe in the horn." He says, "Well, no more I do, your majesty, but what's the difference?" I might as well die on a wild goose chase as die here. He's a very loyal character.
Yeah.
And here, of course, he tells Lucy, "Haven't enough of us died already?" And then the next line he has is, "I'm going with you." And I think they really keep the essence of his character and his loyalty there. And you just love Trumpkin. I mean, I love, even though he is a different take on the character in terms of charisma and personality than he was in the book, I still love the character in the film as much as I can in a film, as much as I do in the book.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Now, of course, here you have Caspian suggesting the duel instead of Peter.
Mm-hmm.
But
I think that makes sense.
yeah, I think for the film, it makes it's a logical progression for, especially for Caspian to have a good idea that he pitches in, and you get the idea that Peter is the one who set up the battle plan with the raid and everything, with the ground underneath the ground and everything. But Caspian has this idea for a duel, and I think in a sense you could say that it's a point they kind of do the opposite to push his character forward into a more mature phase, because in the book Caspian is a mature character. However, he has little moments where, he of course he wants to avenge his father, and he tells Peter that he wants to fight Miraz because he wants to avenge his father. But you realize, Peter has to tell him no, that wouldn't be appropriate. It's not quite the right thing. And here, by having Caspian say, "Hey, how about we let the High King Peter do this service and fight Miraz 1-on-1?" It kind of shows Caspian is, oh, okay, he's able to give Peter glory and reverence where it's due.
Sorry, I'm just reading the bit in the book where this
Oh,
happens.
that's good. You have the book open. That's good.
Yeah, I've got the book with me.
I need to do that more often.
But he thinks of you as a kid. Yeah, it's a similar thing. Caspian obviously realizes in the film that Miraz probably wouldn't take a challenge from him seriously.
Why don't you go ahead and read it from the book? There's that little exchange there.
Very well then, said Peter. I'll send him a challenge to a single combat. No one had thought of this before. Please, said Caspian, could it not be me? I want to avenge my father. You're wounded, said Peter, and anyway, wouldn't he just laugh challenge from you? I mean, we have seen that you are a king and a warrior, but he thinks of you as a kid. And that's where Truffle Hunter comes in.
Yeah. Well, I think, overall, I certainly enjoyed seeing the second battle plans around the stone table more than the first one. But, well, I think that's exhausting that scene. And I think this has been a good discussion overall right here.
Oh, thank you. It's been fun.
Yeah. Thank you very much. I appreciate it. And hopefully we'll have you on again ere too long.
We'll
But with
see.
my schedule changing this fall, it'll probably be a lot more easy for me to do podcasts with people in the UK. So.
Good stuff. Well, thank you very much for having me on.
Oh yeah, thank you, gents.
All right.
That's all for now, and until next time, I'm your host, Julian. Thanks for listening.